Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 119, I'm joined by Dr. Ajay Kurian at the University of Rochester. We discuss the recent annual American Society of Retinal Specialists meeting in Vancouver, Canada. Topics covered include stem cell clinics and their advertising online, as well as the recent five-year result publication of the Protocol S study from the DRCRNet.
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. Ajay Kurian from the University of Rochester. Ajay, welcome back.
Hey, Jay, thanks for having me.
So we're recording this on Thursday, July 26th, and what we're going to do is just recap some of the highlights from the annual American Society of Retinal Specialists ASRS meeting held this past week in Vancouver. You recovered from the jet lag yet?
Almost.
So it was a very action-packed weekend, both personally for both of us. We had a lot of things going on in general in terms of some content. So we're going to talk about a few things, and we're going to end by talking about the five-year Protocol S results, which were announced and also published. But the first thing, you know, Ajay, not to put you on the spot, but you gave an excellent presentation on the opening Saturday about stem cell clinics and these stem cell clinics that are advertising directly to patients. Can you tell us a little bit about what your talk was about and why it's important?
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about this. So what we were looking at was trying to assess what the scope is for these stem cell clinics that exist. When we first published our first three patients that we encountered, we thought it was sort of an isolated event. However, after we published that, we were hearing from a lot of folks that they've had patients who've had other complications as well. And so we really wanted to really figure out what the scope is. And so in order to do that, we figured we would search internet browsers basically to find out where these clinics are and how many there are and how they're delivering care, since that's how most of our patients found out about these clinics in the first place, through internet searches. And so one of my residents, Raj Nirwan, who's actually applying for retina fellowship right now, helped put together this data. And what we found is that there's over 70 clinic locations across the U.S., and this is run by about 40 companies. And they basically advertise doing injections in all parts of the eye. It could be retrobulbar, intravitreal, some even say subretinal injections. And they use cells from all parts of the body that they're trying to isolate it. And overall, when we look at the websites, we see a lot of positive coverage in terms of what they offer or promise, which doesn't match up with what we're seeing in terms of the risks that are also out there with these complications that have arisen.
Right. And this is a pretty important issue. Like I said, one, there's a lot of outcomes tied up in this. There's also a lot of money, unfortunately, tied up in this as well. You know, you guys did an instructional course about stem cells, partly to kind of educate physicians about what actually is viable and what's out there. Contrast what these clinics are advertising versus what is actually on the horizon for patients with, for example, retinal disease who may be interested in stem cell therapy.
So we're definitely very excited about all the early phase study data that's come out from looking at subretinal injections as well as subretinal RPE sheet placement. But these are still very early phase data, just phase one or phase two studies that have some promising results, but still need to be borne out in larger phase three studies in order to have it actually available for our patients outside of the study setting. What we're seeing is that people are hearing about these outcomes of these very promising studies, and then that leads them to do these internet searches. It leads them to these companies. But the key red flags with these companies that separates them from actual scientific research is that, one, patients are being asked to pay out of pocket, sometimes up to $50,000 per injection, which we would not expect to happen in these legitimate clinical trials that are happening, because they have funded either a sponsor, be it a grant funding, or from a company. And then the other thing is that these companies only offer the cell therapies. They're not offering sort of your bread and butter retina treatments, which we'd expect from a practitioner who has multiple options to treat the patient as we do, instead of these companies that are only offering these cell therapies.
So in terms of, you know, you presented as well as Tom Albini, Dr. Elliot Sun, besides, you know, this kind of contrast, any other big takeaways from your stem cell instructional course?
So Elliot Sun did a fantastic job really presenting what's coming up on the horizon. And so they've really made a lot of progress at Iowa in terms of trying to deliver a viable photoreceptor or retinal pigment epithelium scaffold for potentially cells that are driven into forming retina cells that can be used for cell replacement. And so that's really, really exciting to see all the progress that they've made. And Dr. Albini did a great job highlighting the cases that have come in since we've published our initial case. And we are seeing some commonalities of the risk for retinal detachment or severe epiretinal membrane formation after some intravitreal stem cell injections. And so we know that there are some studies going on right now with intravitreal stem cell injections, but they use a very specific stem cell type, and they don't seem to be having these same complications. But it seems like with the allogeneic fat-derived stem cells, we are seeing some of these problems happening in multiple patients.
So Ajay, one of the other instructional courses we were both involved in, which I mentioned on the podcast going into the meeting, was the first ever online content social media course for retinal specialists. And Drs. David Almeida, Charlie Wyckoff, and Sunir Garg were our co-panelists in that. I learned a lot listening to them about what kind of the tricks and tools you can use as a retinal specialist, why it's important to do, and in researching both for my talk and listening to everyone else's talk, I learned quite a bit. As a practicing retinal specialist, what was a couple of things that you learned that you weren't aware of, or things that you'll try to implement in your practice?
Well, you know, first of all, Jay, thanks for putting that all together. You know, you did a fantastic job organizing it and really sort of setting the content for the entire course. And I think there was a lot of really great pearls that we learned there. You know, off the top of my head, I think, Dr. Garg's real emphasis about getting involved in some of this online education and the opportunities that are available for, you know, young clinicians, older clinicians, just anybody who's interested in getting involved with societies, posting videos and stuff like that is very inspirational. You know, other really key points was David Almeida really talked about how to focus some of your online reviews. And so he suggested actually having patients Google their doctors and submitting their reviews. And so that way the same sites that come up most often in people's Google searches will be the ones that you direct patients to. And Charlie had some great points also about trying to encourage patients to do reviews. And overall, it was just a lot of information that for some of it are things that I never really thought about, like, for example, those reviews that we were just talking about.
Yeah, and I thought one of the things that was interesting and when I did kind of the reading to prepare is that there is some data that there may be a correlation between outcomes, at least of institutions, and their ratings. You know, I think that as a medical profession, I think rightly so, we're a little averse and not thrilled about this migration towards patient-centered evaluation of us, because that can be based on many factors that has little to do with good medical care or good physicians. But I think there are two points. One is that even if we don't like it, I think that it is the reality and we do have to adjust to it. And if we do want to have good patient encounters, especially with the younger generation as they kind of get older, or even older people now who are starting using social media, then I like Dr. Garg's point where he talked about, he equated it to going to a restaurant where you've read, you know, a Yelp review before you go and it's got bad reviews. It actually will change your experience about how you experience the food. And I think even if you can be a great physician, you have a great office, you have a great staff, if there's negativity out there and people are bored in their waiting room and they Google you and they don't find things that are positive, then that will color your patient-physician experience. And I never really thought of that way. I'd always, you know, obviously want to be positively thought of and positively portrayed, but I never thought that it might actually change that relationship with the patient, because we all know first impressions are really, really important. But yeah, I thought that it was really good, and we're going to do a similar course at Academy, and hopefully this is something that people found useful and we can continue going forward. Other things in a busy weekend, my colleague, your colleague, but also one of our mentors, Dr. Nina Barakal, received the Crystal Apple Award for fellow teaching and mentorship. Do you just want to talk a little bit about Dr. Barakal? She's been important to a lot of people's career development, and we're all really happy to see her well-deserved award. A little bit about what she's meant for you personally or your career, and how you felt seeing her get that award.
Yeah, I feel so lucky to have been mentored by Dr. Barakal. She is a fantastic surgeon. She has amazing hands and great technique and does a great job explaining what she's thinking about, what she's doing, and gives the fellows really a lot of room to grow in her OR and attachment things, which is always fantastic. The other thing that really sticks out with Dr. Barakal is just what a great person she is to be around. Everybody in her clinic, her OR, all of the staff that work with her, they love her because she does such a good job of really working to build a team around her and making everybody feel like part of the team. And that's something that she always just leads by example with. And that's something that I strive to work towards as well. And it's just so nice to see how kind she is to everybody, from the janitors to the chairman. And that's really something that I strive to emulate as well. And she's just such a fantastic mentor. She's always looking out for opportunities. If she gets like an email about a grant or something like that she thinks I would be a good fit for, she forwards it to me and encourages me to apply. She's just such a fantastic person and mentor. I feel so lucky to have trained with her.
Yeah, I unfortunately had to leave before her talk and her presentation, but I think that was her presentation was actually about that. It was about running a team as a retinal surgeon and the importance of the team. And I do think she's got so many strengths, but I think that one of the more inspirational things I take when I look at her is she really inspires the people around her. She keeps them motivated, she's happy, and they like to work with her. And everyone who works with her like wants to go the extra mile, whether it's the fellow or her photographers or her clinical coordinators. Everyone really wants to work that extra mile. So that was great to see her get that award. From a scientific perspective, there were some great talks and some breaking research. One of the things that came out was presented was Dr. Dougal presented Hawk and Harrier studies looking at brolucizumab versus aflibercept in neovascular AMD patients. Essentially, the take-home points that he mentioned was that 6 milligrams of brolucizumab had superior reduction in central subfoveal thickness versus aflibercept at week 16, and fewer patients in the group had subretinal fluid and intraretinal fluid, and fewer had sub-RPE fluid at week 16. There's some differences in terms of whether those were the primary outcomes, and there was no significant difference in visual acuity improvement between the three treatment arms. Any big takeaways you took from that, Ajay? No, this is a drug that we'll probably see available on the market in the near future. So we'll have to wait and see, I think, what the real-world data look like. But any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that we're all excited about the potential to have a drug that lasts longer and to decrease the injection burden for our patients. The study was designed as a non-inferiority study for the brolucizumab, which had two arms, one just switching to Q12 weeks after the loading dose, and the other one adjusting based on disease activity assessments. But it's a good study. I think the results are interesting. Like you said, there was no statistically significant difference in the visual acuity. It was interesting, though, that there were more letters gained in the Eylea acuity compared to the two brolucizumab arms, even though the central foveal thickness was looking better in the brolucizumab arms. I think, just like any of these other drugs, it's really going to be how our patients are doing with the drug and the indication that the drug has. I remember when Eylea first came out with the Q8 indication, it did lead to some problems with not being able to use it less frequently. And so I think that'll be an important thing to look out for, to see if when brolucizumab happens on the market, if it's going to have the Q-month label or if it's going to be just the Q8 label, sorry, the Q12 label, because that might also affect how it's used.
And, the final big news that broke on Tuesday was the 5-year results of the DRCR NETs Protocol S This was also published in JAMA Ophthalmology to coincide with the talk. And, you know, Ajay, I'm going to just mention some things from the paper that were mentioned in the talk. So as we know, the DR-SphereNet Protocol S study essentially was looking at using ranibizumab versus intravitreal injections of ranibizumab versus panretinal photocoagulation for proliferative diabetic retinopathy in a randomized large clinical trial. The biggest things that to take away, you know, the loss to follow-up was high at 5 years. Vision was not significantly different between the two groups, and the ranibizumab group did have lower rates of diabetic macular edema, as you would expect. Any big takeaways from the talk or the paper, Ajay, in terms of how you apply this to your clinical practice?
Yeah, the results are very consistent with the shorter-term follow-ups, which is good. My concern is just that large loss to follow-up cohort and wondering what happens to them and if there's a difference in them getting PRP versus anti-VEGF injections. And, you know, when I look at the study and think about how to apply the study, I do think about that recent retrospective will study looking at what happens to the patients who are lost to follow-up and some of the really bad outcomes in those patients. I think it's still hard to figure out what the best, or if there is even the best single therapy for PDR. I think at this point right now, it's combination therapy. So, you know, I'm using anti-VEGF and I'm using PRP for almost all my patients, just because I am worried about what happens to them if they fall into that loss to follow-up group without any treatments for a long period of time.
You know, the interesting thing was they didn't give us the stats, but 61% of patients in the ranibizumab group completed their five-year visit versus 69% and in the PRP group. 69% in the ranibizumab group, 65% PRP, actually slightly higher in the ranibizumab group. So not a huge difference. So you would think that maybe subjecting people to 43 visits for the median number of visits for the injection group versus 21, maybe those patients would be less likely, maybe they'd be worn down, maybe less likely to keep coming back. But there was no significant difference in terms of them following up. But that's about a third of patients who don't complete that year five visit. And so that's a great point. You know, Daniel Sue, who's a fellow at Wills, gave a good talk about, I think that, and they compared retrospective data, but when they looked at the patients who got injections only, they had a very high rate of complications such as tractional retinal detachment because of a loss to follow-up. And we'll never know what that cohort, the third that disappeared, looked like, but that's the unknown that we just don't know. And that makes us all a little bit leery about maybe choosing this as primary therapy for these diabetic patients.
Yeah, and, you know, in a study, you have, like, a study coordinator calling them, reminding them, trying to make sure that they do follow up. And in the real world, you just don't have that. All those same things that are, they're trying to keep that patient in the study. Sometimes these patients, they get lost to follow up, and your office might do its standard practice of either calling, sending letters, and things like that. But I don't think it's up to the same level as what the study coordinators do for the studies.
Right. And, you know, the other interesting thing was that there was a worsening in the ranibizumab group in terms of the Humphrey visual field patterns between year two and five. And that brings up an interesting question why that would be. You know, we understand the PRP group, there's some loss of peripheral vision, so the visual fields were worse even in the original publication. But it's interesting why the injection group would lose visual field at that time point. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I do worry about ischemia and that diffusion contributing to that, even in the absence of PRP. And so maybe that is playing a larger role than we had thought before.
Right. The other thing I was thinking is maybe repeated injections. Maybe some of these patients develop glaucomatous nerve fiber layer loss. That was the other thing I was considering, though they didn't really talk about IOP data. Or we do know that maybe some patients are sensitive to these IOP spikes with each injection. But that was also something to note.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Well, either way, it was probably the most anticipated news released at the meeting. It was a great meeting overall. Any other talks, anything else you want to highlight that you learned or did while in Vancouver before we break?
Yeah, it was a great talk. There's a lot of interesting studies. I think one of the interesting studies that I liked was the study from Richard Rosen's group that looked at the immediate blood flow changes after intravitreal injection thought to be secondary to elevated intraocular pressure. And what they did show is that at 5 minutes using ST angiography, that there's a fairly large amount of decreased perfusion, both in the macula and to the optic nerve head. And so thinking back to what you were saying about the visual field loss, that could certainly be something that contributes to that over time with all of these injections.
Yeah, that's a great point. And again, I think that that's something we need to be more cognizant of, and something we've talked about before, and that there are these immediate changes and maybe long-term changes too. Well, Ajay Kurian, thank you so much. I know it's been crazy since you got back from Vancouver, and it was a good recap of the meeting. There's tons of ways to consume the meeting, even if you didn't go. If you're a member of ASRS, they've been sending out kind of daily updates via Retina Times, reviewing each of the talks. If you're not a member of ASRS, you're not subscribed there, Yoshi Yonakawa at Retina Roundup has a team of fellows and doctors been writing summaries at retinaroundup.com. Those were excellent as well. So kind of what we talked about at our course, so many ways to keep up, even if you didn't have a chance to go. And don't forget, on iTube, there's multiple interviews with many doctors, as well as in the Academy One Network, including Ajay Kurian himself, both as an interviewer and an interviewee. So lots of ways to keep up with the meeting, even if you didn't have a chance to make it all the way to Vancouver.
Great. Thanks again for having me, Jay.
All right. Have a great night.
Take care, man.
Bye-bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 119 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You'll also find our blog, Equal Rounded Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes, and at the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. We're on Facebook, and you can also find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Many thanks to Dr. Ajay Kurian for joining me. Thank you to Louis Kai, Mike Benincasa, and Angela Chang for producing this great episode. Thank you to everyone who came out to our social media course in Vancouver, and hopefully we'll see some of you again at Chicago for Academy. And thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreather, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the